Welcome to Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Talk of the Bay comes your way Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. on KSQD. I'm your Thursday afternoon host, Rachel Ann Goodman. Today on the program, we'll be talking about climate change and what communities and groups are doing to push governments to act. We hear especially from people under 18 today, the under 16-year-old climate activists who recently petitioned Congress to act. And then we'll hear from Santa Cruz's Climate Action Director about local efforts to combat sea level rise. And finally, from a journalist who covered the story, a look at Capitola, our local city, which is a case study for what cities might do right and possibly wrong in the coming decades where sea levels will be rising. We'll get our first guest ready, and before we do, we're going to hear just a few voices from a recent action by local students. And when we're talking about students, we're talking about second and third graders who have felt so strongly about the issue that they went out into the streets and pleaded with their leaders to do something about climate change. Here's a short bit from them, and then we'll be talking with two young climate activists about their recent trip to Washington and what they encountered there. And even elementary schools all around the world, children took time out to talk to me about why they felt it was important to show up. They also mentioned being inspired by Greta Thunberg, the young Swedish girl who has inspired countless students to stand up for change about climate change. So here's their voices from the Santa Cruz Clock Tower student walkout in Santa Cruz. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman. Why are you here and what's important about this?
I am here, well, because I need to be. Everyone needs to come. Like, our world is being destroyed. You can't say I'll go tomorrow because soon enough there won't be a tomorrow. We need a future. And if people in power won't give it to us, then we'll get it ourselves.
Let's put it this way. We don't need the people who invent the self-driving car. We need the people who invent the flying car. We don't need improvement, we need change.
I'm here to support climate change and to help there be a tomorrow. I'm here to help all the kids everywhere have a long, happy life and not have the planet destroyed in the process.
And there you have it, some voices from our local school children here in Santa Cruz County. And joining us by telephone are two people who have really stepped out in the climate justice movement, Jonah Gottlieb and Devin Del Palacio. They're both here with us on the show. Hi, you guys. How's everything going?
Hey, thanks.
Welcome to Talk of the Bay, and thank you so much for being here. There's a little bit of an echo. I'm not sure why, but we'll see if we can't change that. So tell me what moved you to get involved with the climate action movement. A lot of people say they were inspired by Greta Thunberg. Both of you are very involved. Jonah is a 16-year-old student who helped plan the Youth and Educator Congressional Climate Summit at the Capitol recently. And Devin Del Palacio is the chair of the Black Council of National School Board Association and is now on the advisory board of Schools for Climate Action. Tell me what moved each of you, and we'll start with you, Devin. Devin, are you there?
Sorry, this is Nevin. I think there may be a little confusion with the name.
Sorry, Nevin.
I'm actually a student.
Sorry, yes. So, hi, Nevin. Sorry about the confusion. Tell me what moved you to get involved with this issue.
Yeah, so I've been working with Schools for Climate Action for about a year now, and one thing that really inspired me to enter into the whole environmental movement was going to Bioneers and really seeing how these issues were affecting different communities, especially our indigenous communities here in the United States, and I think that was what really inspired me to get involved and start taking action.
And where are you from?
I'm from Santa Rosa, California.
And I don't know if you could hear some of the children that were on just a minute ago, but, you know, there's nothing more clear than people saying you're endangering our future and just this plea from the next generation. It's hard to imagine that not reaching people. What has been the response to what you're doing by adults, people in power?
Right. For the most part, I think a lot of adults understand the issues facing us, and they understand how scary and intimidating it can feel. And for a lot of adults, even though they understand They still have yet to really take a stand on this issue and have yet to speak up in their community. So we've had a lot of positive support, and we're really grateful for all the adults that do support us. But there definitely are some that hear our struggle and continue to ignore it.
There was a pretty famous and it went viral video of Dianne Feinstein, our representative here in California, pretty much saying, "You kids just don't know anything about politics. Why are you here?" I don't know if you saw that and what your reaction was.
Yeah, I did see that video. You know, I think there's a lot of things going on in that video. I do think that there could have been a lot of other ways that whole situation could have been handled. But I do want to say that Feinstein mentioned that she's been in power. She's been in this seat for 30 years, and 30 years is also the amount of time that we have known, that the government has known about climate change and about how it affects our lives. So while she is acting, we would have really liked to see her lend all of her experience, those 30 years, and all of her knowledge about how things have to work, if she could lend that to the students, because it's obvious that they need climate action but don't have the skills to create it because, yeah, they're unexperienced, right? They're students. And she can meet them with her experience, and I think that would be a much better way than just dismissing them in that way that she did.
Yeah, that it seemed like a bit of a missed opportunity at very least that could have happened, a nice dialogue that could have been. And that was the Sunrise Movement. Are you part of that group of young people?
I am not.
But you know about the Sunrise Movement?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think one thing that makes Schools for Climate Action different than the Sunrise Movement is that they are lobbying specifically for the Green New Deal, whereas with Schools for Climate Action, we're advocating, not lobbying. So we're not endorsing one particular law. We just are asking that all options and all possibilities are looked at and acted on promptly.
And Jonah, do we have you on the other line?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your involvement, how you got into this work, and why.
So I was always really into politics, but I got interested in climate change specifically following the fires in Sonoma County in the fall of 2017. So I got connected with Hart Guthrie a few months after that, who's the co-founder of Schools for Climate Action, and we've been working on really working within the system to get educated, to get ed sector leaders to call out this generational justice issue and really put Congress on notice that they need to act now and that their constituents will be behind them when they act out if they're protecting our generation.
Now, you will be able to vote in a couple of years. Are you looking forward to that moment?
Counting down the days, yeah. Except the 2020 election.
You will be able to vote. Yeah, so the people like Dianne Feinstein who dismissed this organization and this movement are doing it at their peril in some ways because there's a whole bunch of voters coming down the pike who will be able to vote in 2020. So that'll be an interesting moment to see how many of the people who have, you know, maybe not ever voted before actually vote for the first time. And especially if this issue brings them out into the ballot box to vote for the first time. Tell me what the goals are of what you want to see happen. What, you know, is the 2 to 5 year plan in your view that would be satisfactory in terms of movement toward addressing climate change?
We need Congress to take action right now. And if they're not going to do that, then immediately following the election in 2020, on Inauguration Day 2021, then we'll have someone else who will take action because it's needed urgently. So what Schools for Climate Action is really doing is, again, putting Congress on notice that the majority of the American people believe in climate change, over 70%. Among our generation, it's closer than 90% believe that we need to act on climate change. So we're just really sending out a warning that you will be replaced if you don't legislate with our future in mind.
And let me ask Nevin, do you feel like you have found some allies in Congress and other places that are going to be advocates for you? Can you name anybody that has said, yes, I want to do this with you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of the Congress, we had meetings this past week in D.C. We had meetings with a few Congress people and a few staffers. And I think specifically Mike Thompson and Senator Whitehouse, both we had the chance to speak a little bit more in depth with them at our event. And I think both of them are really not only aware of how these issues affect us on the surface level and, you know, economically and all that, but I think they really have a true sense of how it feels to have people choosing their personal profit over your future and your livelihood. And I think they can see that facing our generation. So they don't just go about talking about it like, oh, this is another, you know, this is another political issue. I really think that they move and legislate from a place of understanding how this affects our, you know, our mental health and our sense of hope and our sense of, our sense of hope.
So just talking to you, Jonah, about your experience, have you found the same thing or something different?
I've really found that for the most part, people in Congress and their staffs have really been really excited about how many young people are involved, even if they don't particularly agree with what we're saying. People have just been so interested with youth involvement in general, and it's been great because, you know, now political engagement and civic engagement is the cool thing to do among our generation. But so I was talking to some staffers the other day who were saying that in terms of talking to people who aren't ready, people in Congress who aren't ready to act on climate change, they said that one young person having a conversation with them would do just as much good as 10 conversations with a staffer from the other party in terms of swaying their decision-making on the issue of climate change. So youth getting involved is a huge step in the right direction in terms of swaying these members of Congress decision-making, because they really want to listen to kids.
That's very encouraging what you're saying. I mean, I'm hoping more and more people are susceptible to this message because it's coming from moral authority. You can't possibly, you know, have any other agenda than the survival of yourselves and the planet. But even given that, there are still some people out there, some, I would say, far fringe conspiracy nuts who try to deny that it's happening. And second, say that, you know, somehow you were paid, you know, actors that are going out there, you know, and trying to work for, I don't know who you'd be working for, but somehow this isn't real and that it's, you know, a manufactured movement. How do you even respond to that kind of accusation of this youth movement?
I would first start out with, if I was a crisis actor and I was getting paid for all this, then I would not be looking for as many scholarships as I am for college. But it's a little ridiculous because they're doing it either being purposely misled or misleading other people themselves, knowing that this exists and just completely disregarding science. You know, we're all in school right now, and it's disheartening knowing that we're learning things that will be ignored by many people in power. And it's honestly just kind of ridiculous that people are still ignoring just the facts of climate change. You know, you always see these debates on TV about climate change and it's one-on-one, but it's 97-3 in terms of scientists who believe that climate change is happening. And Congress is really not representative of the will of the American people. Over 70% of the American people believe in climate change, and yet we still have close to half who aren't right now willing to take meaningful action on this issue.
Well, you're doing a lot to push them toward toward that. And of course, they're getting pushback from donors from the fossil fuel industry who don't seem too concerned about the future. They're looking for short-term profits. And I wonder if you've ever had a conversation with someone from the fossil fuel lobby or even directly from the industry and tried to talk to them directly, because that's your opponent, not necessarily Congress. We're in a system where you can buy Congress, it sounds like, for the price of a very large donation to someone's campaign. Not everyone is buyable, but there are definitely some who are. I was wondering if either of you, Nevin or Jonah, who I'm talking to, they're from Northern California, and they've been very involved with getting schools involved with the climate action debate. I'm wondering if either of you have had the chance to try to make your case directly to anybody in power in the fossil fuel industry.
I haven't yet.
Jonah?
I will say that, yeah.
I can speak to...
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. I can definitely speak to the situation that we had. A few of us went to deliver some of our resolutions and to just have a little informal chat with some of the staffers in Senator Imhoff's office. And if you're not familiar, he's the person who brought a snowball onto the Senate floor with making the claim that because he had a snowball in his hand, that climate change is not real and that it's not happening. It's a lie. And so we had a pretty tense, frank conversation with his staffers about how they, by being employed by this senator, they're participating in this spread of misinformation. And it's not a harmless fiction. It's really could be this climate denial versus climate action could really be life or death for us as young people. And so I think from talking to them, it was clear that, you know, they do have a general understanding of, you know, the science, or maybe, you know, carbon in the atmosphere makes it hotter. They have this general understanding, but aren't, you know, their value system is based on money and economics. Their value system isn't based on people's lives. It's just like we have different values, and that just became very apparent to me. And I just don't think it's acceptable to have that kind of value system ruling our country in any way.
Jonah, did you have another story to add to that one?
Yeah, so just to kind of paraphrase what Senator Sheldon Whitehouse was saying at our summit last week, and, you know, this is before most of us in this movement can really remember, but back before the Citizens United decision, there was real bipartisan efforts to combat climate change. But then after that, just the flow of dark money from the fossil fuel industry has really, you know, penetrated our political system. And you see that with people like former Congressman Bob Inglis, who is a Republican, who after the Citizens United decision stuck to his principles and kept working on the issue of climate change. And then he was primaried and voted out of office because he just didn't have the financial support, and his opponents were all supported by the fossil fuel industry. So we really need to get this dark money out of politics in order to really make a difference. Now, we have seen of late companies like Chevron and Exxon and Shell are starting to really be aware of how our generation feels about the issue of climate change. So I'm seeing every day now ads on Snapchat from Exxon and Chevron about how they're combating climate change and creating carbon sequestering mechanical plants and things like that. So they are starting to be put on notice, but it's still a PR campaign in the end, and we need them to take real action, and we need to get this dark fossil fuel money out of politics so that we can have a Congress that's representative of the will of the American people so that they can fight for our future and not their special interests.
Well said. And if you just joined us here on Talk of the Bay, I'm Rachel Ann Goodman, and we're talking with Jonah Gottlieb, co-director of School for Climate Action, And Nevin, who's also involved with that organization and on the same organization, I believe, and both of them have been involved in really lobbying their congresspeople to pay attention to this issue. It is a life or death issue, and it seems like you are making some headway in that regard, for which we thank you. And it obviously can't just be the young people speaking, although you do speak with a moral authority because of your age and what's ahead of you that people who may be older, lack. And so there is a strength in that. And you saw it in the Parkland shooting issue as well, that students were saying, look, it's not about money, it's about our lives. And they just didn't feel like people were listening. And I think they actually did get some laws changed. It took a lot of effort and will continue, I'm sure. What's next for you? What kinds of things are on the horizon as far as actions or things that give you hope that you want to get involved with?
I'll start with Jordan. Schools for Climate Action. We're still working on passing school board, student council, PTA, and teachers union resolutions. So just for some background on our organization, what we do is we work with ed sector organizations to pass resolutions that do three things. First of all, they define climate change very clearly as either a children's issue or a generational justice issue, and they really speak to the fact that climate change disproportionately affects our generation and future generations, the students and young people who they are serving. The second thing they do is they help the districts improve their sustainability efforts and climate curriculum at the local level so that this action on climate change is normalized in the minds of students. So in the future, we can really have the American populace be in the same mindset about how we need to take action on climate change. And the last thing they do is they specifically call on Congress to take action on climate change. So we're still working to pass these resolutions. And if our listeners here are interested, they can find out more information on our website, schoolsforclimateaction.com. We're really expanding. We've passed now 65 across the country in 12 states plus D.C. in a little over a year. So we're still working on that to really put Congress on notice, because less than 1% of all elected school board members right now have officially taken a position on climate change, and to us, that needs to change. So we're still working on that. We'll be having some more events in the future, but please contact us if you'd like to get involved. We're eager to spread.
Is one of the things you're working on, maybe you said this, but I missed it, trying to get in the curriculum a regular unit or even a whole class about this into high schools and middle schools?
Yes. So we are working on that, and it obviously it varies district to district on how successful that is and the nature of that curriculum, but we are working on that. Speaking personally, I go to Credo High School in Roanoke Park, California, and the first class that you take at Credo High School is entitled Climate Change. Hmm. And we really look at just how it affects our every facet of our life, from healthcare, the environment, economics, you name it. It affects really every political issue. And for me, that really just set everything on this issue in motion, because I had this knowledge on what was wrong with the world and what we needed to fix, I was really able to step out into my own on this issue and take action. So if every single student has that experience and every single student knows about this issue and is able to speak about this issue and is able to take action about this issue, just imagine what we can do.
Well, it's really heartening to hear all you're doing, because it's tempting to just get despairing when you see that nothing's happening in our country, or not nothing, because there you are making change happen. Some final thoughts for you, Nevin. What's on the horizon that you're excited about that makes you get up in the morning with some optimism?
Yeah, definitely connecting with other organizations, connecting with other youth, and really every resolution we pass, we've had some great results with school board resolutions. But I think for me, especially seeing those student council resolutions, yes, it's just a piece of paper, but it, with the strong message to Congress and knowing that there are people behind that resolution, there are other students that recognize this issue, recognize how important it is. And so I think, like, yeah, seeing more of these student council resolutions would be amazing. And we had such an awesome time in D.C. that I think we'll be doing another trip and delivering more resolutions. So I would really encourage a lot more schools and student councils to pass resolutions like the ones we have.
And can you give out your website one more time before we say goodbye?
It's schoolsforclimateaction.org.
.com.
It's .com. schoolsforclimateaction.com. You can find example resolutions, resolutions we've already passed, news, ways of contacting us. Everything is on the website, so please check it out.
Thank you so much for being here with us on Talk of the Bay and sharing all that you're doing to make sure we have a planet for your generation. Thank you for being here with us on Talk of the Bay. All right, you take
care.
All right. And we were speaking there with Jonah Gottlieb and Nevin, who are both very involved in getting their schools to pass resolutions to definitely get climate change top priority in Congress as well as in their local school boards. In just a moment, we'll be talking with Tiffany Wise West. She is the Climate Action Coordinator for the City of Santa Cruz, and we'll hear about a conference coming to Santa Cruz that is sponsored by UC Santa Cruz and has a number of big speakers involved coming your way in just a couple of days. So stay with us. We have a couple of announcements, and we'll be right back.
KSQD thanks Growing Up in Santa Cruz for supporting this program. Growing Up in Santa Cruz offers monthly news and views for Santa Cruz families and a calendar of local family events. Growing Up in Santa Cruz can be found for free in locations throughout Santa Cruz County. Thank you for supporting Community Radio, KSQD 90.7 FM.
This is Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 FM. KSQD is a brand new, only just 7 weeks old radio station that was started by community members to serve the communities of Santa Cruz, Monterey, San Benito counties. And public service is what we're all about. We're here to serve your information needs and cover local issues. And there's probably nothing more important in some ways than our relationship with the climate and our ocean right here on the Central Coast. The ocean dominates our lives. We can't ignore it. On stormy days, it really dominates our lives. It has caused some trouble in flooding, but it's also the livelihood for many, many people around the bay, whether it's tourism or fisheries or simply just looking at its beauty. And one of the people who's been charged with raising awareness and figuring out what Santa Cruz County and City is going to do about that is Tiffany Wise West, who's here with us in studio. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Rachel. It's nice to be back.
Thank you for having us on your show. It's your show now. So, Tiffany, tell us what is in your job description? Saving us from mayhem and collapse of civilization, or what's your job description?
Oh, goodness, that's a big
tall order.
Yeah, that's a tall order. So I'm the Sustainability and Climate Action Manager for the City of Santa Cruz. So I lead our development of the emissions reduction strategy across the city, as well as our climate adaptation strategy. So how do we deal with the impacts of climate change? And that's my role.
What did you think about the interview we just had, listening to those kids? They're 16.
It's so inspiring. I have to say, this real huge influx of motivation and engagement with youth is so necessary and so inspiring. I'm just thrilled to be able to work with students and youth on this. I think that, you know, they have not only the energy, but they have the compelling story. As your previous speakers mentioned, that, you know, these impacts are really truly going to be affecting them more than my generation, your generation. And I think that that's very compelling.
And, you know, they were saying we've known about this for 30 years. And I couldn't help but think, as I was listening to all the effort they're putting into passing resolutions and trying to get people to do stuff, that that would be the first step. All this energy just to try to move, you know, people's brains so that they start acting. When we start acting, there's going to be a lot more to do, you know, just retooling our world so that it works in a way that's more sustainable is going to take effort all by itself once you decide to do it. And that leadership, you can't do it individually. If we all decided tomorrow to walk everywhere, it still wouldn't quite solve the problem. We would need some way to get around.
Absolutely. It's so true. And, you know, something that really resonated with me from your previous speakers is the notion of normalizing the understanding that climate change is real. We have science to back it up, and it's time to face it. I think that, you know, here, of course, in Santa Cruz, we live in a bubble, and even in California, that this is rather normalized. But across the country, that is not the case. So I think in passing these resolutions across the country, that begins to normalize the conversation, which is so critical to get beyond California and, you know, to the folks all across the United States.
So even though we are in a bubble, we are having a conference on climate change. What's the goal of the conference? It's a UC Santa Cruz climate conference. It's, I think, in its third year. Tell us what the goal is.
Yeah, so this year the focus is really on climate resilience and environmental justice. And this is a topic that the city of Santa Cruz has certainly taken to heart very recently with our climate adaptation plan update that was adopted in just this past year, where we completed our first social vulnerability to climate change assessment. So at the conference, we are going to be talking about that as the theme. Not only is Gary Griggs, who of course is, you know, the big name in the room, and really the probably the leader in the state, if not the country, on sea level rise, but also a couple other organizations who are doing on the ground environmental justice work. And so I'm really eager to have a conversation with them about what we're doing and to learn from them, because this is, you know, although the city of Santa Cruz and the Climate Action Program over the past couple of years has started to take up this notion of environmental justice and has started to infuse it in our work, there's always something to learn. We can always do better. Are we doing it right? Are we speaking the right language? That's something I'm really interested in talking about is, you know, what's the right language to talk about environmental justice? And then, of course, you know, the overarching concern about frontline communities who disproportionately suffer from the impacts of climate change. And how can we really start to change that? You know, I'm very excited for that dialogue.
That's a wonderful thing to talk about. And, you know, when you talk about climate justice, I think what you're talking about is the poor people of color are the one that get hit the first because they're living in the low rent areas like beach flats. And that's, of course, the lowlands. And in yes. Appalachia, it was right along the river. And that's who flooded first, always. It was the people on the hill that, you know, would wring their hands, but they weren't living down at the in the flats. So
right.
that's the essential part of it.
Absolutely. So yeah, we're definitely talking about people of color, people who are living with poverty, definitely in the beach flats area. But there also are other groups, elderly folks who may have mobility issues in the case of, you know, a climate emergency or a weather emergency, who can't necessarily evacuate quickly enough. People that live in crime areas who may be afraid to come outside of their house. So yeah, there's, you know, all of these different groups. And, you know, again, talking about our Santa Cruz bubble, folks may not realize that we have those very groups of people living in Santa Cruz. So it really, I think, requires that intentionality and that concerted effort to meet these folks where they are and engage them in the work that we're doing, not only in the developing the methodologies and the solutions, but keeping them in the loop on all of this as we go forward. I think it's just so critical. And, you know, we were really fortunate to be able to make the contacts in all of those communities through our adaptation plan development process and the outreach process. And so, you know, going forward, we're able to leverage those relationships and like I said, do better.
Mm. Tell us again when this conference is.
Yeah, so it's where? It's 1 week from today, April 11th, and it's at the Rio Theater. And I'm afraid to say I can't remember the time. I think it's it's an evening event. I believe it's 6 or 6:30. I know there's a registration on it that I think either opened this week or is opening soon. So folks should go online and find that. I know UCSC has been promoting it, and if you do a simple web search, I'm sure you can find it as well as the registration link.
So one thing you said kind of sparked my interest, and that is, you know, during the Chico fire, some of the tragic stories were of the elderly who couldn't get out quick enough, and it just felt such a letdown to our grandparents and our elders to leave them in their final hours like that. And I know that it came so fast, there was nothing they could do. Is there anything the city could do to locate, know who the people are who can't get moving quickly and have a plan to get them out of harm's way, whether it's a fire or flood?
Yeah, believe it or not, when we were completing our climate adaptation plan update, which was done concurrently with our local hazard mitigation plan, we actually pulled out the routing for evacuations and saw, you know, our fire department and police department, they've already identified that the first folks that they need to get to are the old folks' homes, the, you know, care facilities, those kinds of things. So I was really glad to see that, because we were, of course, doing the social vulnerability to climate change assessment. We learned a lot about, you know, where people in the city are living with respect to these different drivers of social vulnerability. And so, you know, that's something that they've already got programmed into their evacuation routing. But, you know, some other things that we can do that we're having conversations about is, you know, if there is acute flooding coming, we can be doing reverse 911 calls in Spanish. And in fact, all of our literature that's going out on flood should be in Spanish as well, because we know that the Spanish-speaking community is located in the Beach Flats area, many are, and, you know, we want to make sure that they have the information to be able to both prepare and respond. So those are just a couple of examples of how we've used the social vulnerability to climate change to initiate some conversation. But we really admittedly have just scratched the surface. So I'm really looking forward with our two upcoming Resilient Coast Santa Cruz projects of really expanding upon that. And again, have some really intentionality set around including those folks in these projects, both in developing the solutions and then getting it out to all of our community.
Let me just give out the website. It's climateconference.ucse.edu, and it's happening April 11th at 6:30, the 6th Annual Climate Science and Policy Conference. Title is Climate Justice, Linking Science to Just Action, and the speakers are Gary Griggs, Alvaro Sanchez of the Greenlining Institute, Vien Truong from Green for All and Dream Corps, and our guest in the studio here, Tiffany Wise-West, the City of Santa Cruz Climate Action Director. And before we go, I just hope you don't mind if I ask you only a slightly personal question, but I ask this of a lot of people who work on this issue, which is, how do you keep optimistic because it is your job to focus on worst case scenarios?
No, absolutely. I was actually just talking to one of my interns about this today. And quite frankly, working with young people and the energy and inspiration that they bring, that keeps me going, as well as thinking about, I do think a lot about these socially vulnerable communities and how disadvantaged they are in their ability to prepare and respond. And that really motivates me as well. So I think between the youth and, you know, the knowing that there are folks out there that need help with this, between the two, that really kind of keeps me moving along and doing the work that we're doing across Santa Cruz.
Well, I certainly appreciate you coming in today on Talk of the Bay. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Tiffany Wise-West, my guest here on Talk of the Bay. And in just a moment, we'll be speaking with Hugh McCormick. He's a journalist for the Good Times who covered a story in Capitola about sea level rise. And we're going to find out what the city of Capitola did when they were faced and are faced with a continuing battle with the sea level right outside their door. We'll do that in just a moment. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, and I'm Catherine Bell of the Dream Journal. Do you sometimes wake up with a dream ringing in your head? I'm passionate about helping you use that curiosity to transform your waking life. I'll have interviews, announcements, live call-ins, and lots of great dream music. So tune in to the Dream Journal Saturday mornings from 10 to 11 a.m. and get your dream on.
Hey there, sleepyhead. What are you doing up so early? Have you tried Deep Dive, K-Squid's new morning show?
Woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb.
Diving deep into
head.
A sea of great music.
Get up, you sleepyhead.
Keeping you up on traffic.
Damn, this traffic jam.
Weather.
Don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows.
Surf conditions. Plus California and local news. That's Deep Dive, 6 to 8 a.m. Yes, 6 to 8 a.m. on 90.7 K-Squid with your hosts, Michael Tanner, Jimmy Grimes, Charlie Lang, Cynthia D., and me, Rachel Ann Goodman. Hope to see you on the radio.
The early birdie gets the worm. To get ahead, you better.
That's right, I'll be up here 6 a.m. Hope you'll join me. Yes, you can set your alarm to K-Squid, KSQD, 90.7 FM. That's what you're tuned to, and this is Talk of the Bay. We're talking about another kind of a deep dive, which is what we might do if we don't do anything. And one of the people here joining me on the radio is Hugh McCormick, and full disclosure, is one of my students.
Yes, yes, you're the best teacher ever.
I paid you to say that.
Yep, basically, yeah.
Thanks for coming in.
You gave me an A in mass media studies. I really appreciate that.
It's so nice to see you working in the field, working for the good times.
You gave me the letter of recommendation that I needed, so thank you very much, and thanks for letting me be on your show.
It's great
honor.
To have you.
Thanks.
It's great to have you here and to have read your article. I always cheer when I see articles by my students. And this article was about the city of Capitola dealing with sea level rise.
Yeah, yeah. I was actually inspired. I've worked for the Good Times for 2 years now. And I was inspired by the Santa Cruz's Climate Action Plan 2018, reading about the sea level rise and, you know, the effects of climate change on the Central Coast. Initially, it was Santa Cruz. And then, you know, once I figured out how much this is going to impact the Central Coast, I couldn't help but think about my beloved Capitola Village. You know, grew up in SoCal and did junior lifeguards in the summer and enjoyed Pizza My Heart and all the things that the village had to offer. And
so, what's the prognosis for it? Is it looking not so good?
Prognosis negative. Yeah, the city of Santa Cruz's climate action plan actually. It predicts that sea level rise is going to rise 4 inches in 2030 and a whopping 28 inches by 2060. And I couldn't, you know, help but imagine, you know, 28 inches of sea level just rushing through Capitola Village and stuff. So I was inspired to go down to the village and talk to businesses and also dig a little bit into what government officials are doing to, you know, save the village, or at least, you know, combat climate change and be ready for the changing world that we have.
When I went to Kauai recently, and they have tsunamis, you know, they also have sea level rise because they're a tiny island. Everybody's houses, not everyone's, but a lot of the houses are up on stilts. Is that something you heard from store owners, is just, you know, raise everything up?
Yeah, I've heard that a couple of times. How you actually raise up an entire village, you know, and how much that's going to cost is anybody's guess. But the government officials, the mayor that I talked to actually mentioned raising Capitola Village up. And I just, you know, I've been to the village 1,000 times and I just can't imagine how that would actually happen, you know, raising roads, raising businesses and stuff. It just doesn't seem feasible to me.
It doesn't to me either. I can imagine maybe paying people to move out, you know, so that you didn't have to keep rebuilding. Yeah. And that's what some places in New Orleans and parts of New Orleans have done, is just like, you know what, don't even rebuild there, because the not only the taxpayers end up, but the insurance companies can't insure you anymore.
Yeah, when I talked to Mayor Jacques Bertrand. Yeah. He actually mentioned specifically who's going to pay for it, you know? How much money is it going to take to save the village, basically?
Did he have a figure?
No, but he said raising all the buildings and moving them inward, that's a huge project. And I've talked to Peter Jesberg, who's he's responsible for maintenance, construction of parks, roads, and public facilities. His entire department is only three people, and nobody right now is 100% devoted to climate change or even, you know, thinking about climate change and the way it's going to affect Capitol Village, which is in a low-lying area. That is, you know, going to be under threat, 28 inches of sea level rise, 2060, you know, it could, Capitola by the sea could literally be Capitola in the sea.
To mention the beaches themselves, I think you wrote about the sand being, they made some sort of jetty so that the sand would flow onto the beach instead of past them by. The beaches themselves would be underwater, so that's a main tourism driver. I mean, people don't necessarily go to the ocean just to look at it. They
how to save the beach.
Want to
I
get
mean,
in
that
there.
Is something that Capitol is actually doing right now. In the next 2 years, they're going to rebuild the jetty. It was built in 1960s, and it's falling apart. It's in shambles right now. So Peter Jesberg told me that in the next 2 years, they're definitely going to rebuild the jetty to try to salvage the beach. Without a jetty, sand is literally ripped off the beach, you know, and making the jetty makes the beach wider and healthier. But even, you know, the most optimistic people don't really see Capitola Beach surviving, you know, in year 2060, even with a jetty. There's good reason to think that, you know, the beloved beach that we all grew up on and tanned on and ate pizza on and stuff is going to be gone literally by 2060. Yeah.
The potential loss of places, and this is if we do stuff, right? If we don't do anything, it might be worse, but this is without, with some change of our behavior happening. Are there two scenarios by which they have different levels of rise, or was there just one, this is going to happen regardless?
Yeah, I mean, it's a projection, you know, it's a guess, but it's an educated guess.
And wasn't there a scientist you checked in with who just had a report about the different levels? What was his name again?
I talked to Patrick Bernard, who's worked 15 years as a coastal geologist with the USGS, Pacific Coastal Science Center, as a research director. And he says that sea level rise is definitely going to pose a major problem for communities up and down the coast. But especially for Capitola, the village itself is built right at sea level on a floodplain of a river. Between the ocean and the creek, it's extremely vulnerable, and it's in a position. And I went down to the Capitola Village and spent a day, you know, talking to the business owners and stuff. And my beloved Pizza My Heart, first location of Pizza My Heart, you know, flagship. Now there's dozens. And the people, at, like, you know, working at Pizza My Heart see this, you know, creek behind them and then see this encroaching sea, you know, in front of them. They feel kind of trapped and boxed in. And a lot of the businesses I talk to are less hopeful about the future now that they, you know, have read reports like the Santa Cruz Climate Action Plan and stuff and know that sea level rise is coming. But they're experiencing it on like a monthly, you know, sometimes weekly basis now.
How did they experience it?
Whether like storm drains are blocked, you know, pretty much they're laying out sandbags every day during the winter.
Really?
Yeah. The sea is going over the little tiny, you know, seawall, I guess. And, it's definitely coming into the village already. Patrick Bernard says that even, you know, the 4 inches of sea level, that's expected on the central coast, you know, this could have long lasting impacts on sea level communities like Capitola. Just a few inches of sea level rise can cause 100-year events, you know, we've seen a couple of those, to occur every 5 years. He doesn't know, Patrick Bernard doesn't know whether, you know, Capitola has the resource it's going to take to, like, you know, save the village or, you know, save the people who rely on it, on a daily basis. You know, this can affect tourism, this can affect a lot of things, you know, in Capitola Village.
Part of my practical brain says, well, we should be just getting out of the way now before it happens, because it's starting to happen. But there's nowhere to get out of the way to, right? It's not like there's empty space up on the bluff where all those pretty, there's some really nice houses up there, but I bet they don't want to give up the space for Pizza My Heart to move up onto the, out of the way of the ocean.
Probably not. No. And you know, the mayor and, Jesper told me that, I mean, raising the village might be the only option available, but, you know, that's going to cost millions and millions of dollars. They're not very sanguine about the future, and they're really not doing much right now, you know, save, you know, rebuilding the jetty, which is kind of a quick fix. And, One of the things that Patrick Bernard told me was that with climate change, in the future, waves are going to be actually coming from the south instead of the northwest.
Why is that?
It's just the way that the tides are, you know, going to change. That's what's projected. And so Capitola is going to start being hit by, you know, waves coming from the south. So it's going to be a direct hit. The waves are going to get stronger. Coastal storms are going to be more effective and more brutal and more damaging. And, you know, 100-year events are going to start, happening every 5 years, and the village is going to flood, you know, and life is going to be disrupted. And, you know, right now, most of what Capitola, the city of Capitola is doing is kind of reactive instead of proactive. They're just hoping for the best, basically, and telling businesses to have your sandbags out, you know, like...
That's not exactly encouraging information.
And it's
though,
funny, they're like, the mayor was like, yeah, the sandbags work, but he knows the writing's kind of on the wall. Like, he knows that, like, you know, there's only, you can only build, what did he write? Sandbags will soon be ineffective. You can't build high enough. You can't hold the water back at some point. Which is, you know, if the mayor is really kind of not totally, you know, excited or kind of worrying about the future, yet nothing's being done. I don't know. It's a strange situation, I guess.
It definitely is. Well, yeah. I appreciate you coming in and sharing. And if people haven't read your article, it's in the most recent edition of the Good Times free paper that's in Santa Cruz County. They can also find it online.
Yeah, and this is my first time on K-Squid and pretty much my first time on the radio, so I hope I did a good job. Rachel's
did
the best
great job.
Teacher ever.
Well,
I mean, save Capitola. Like, the businesses I've talked to down at Capitola really want to save their village, and they're willing to, you know, work hard to do that. And I want to watch the little junior guards run around in the summer in their red bathing suits, you know, for a century, you know, and not have it all be gone by 2060, because, you know, it's a cultural icon, and it's a place that Santa Cruz loves and a lot of people have, you know, really deep feelings for. So,
yes, yeah. It's really a hard thing to hear you tell us that it might just go away.
It's
so let's
hardest
hope
for me, man.
I bet it is, because you have a long history. Well, thank you for coming in. And I hope you come in again, because we would like to develop a regular relationship with the Good Times so that we can have the reporters share what they're learning.
It's an honor. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back. We have a new program on Talk of the Bay that we're going to be doing every couple of weeks called Santa Cruz Local. It's a new podcast, and this is episode 11, so they've been at it some time. This is Kara Myberg, Guzman, and Stephen Baxter, who used to be working with the Sentinel, who've gone out on their own, and they're going to do this short feature for you just now.
Welcome to Santa Cruz Local, where we watch our public institutions and hold power to account. I'm Kara Myberg Guzman. For months, the city of Santa Cruz has been grappling with what to do about the Ross Camp, a haphazard, unsanctioned homeless camp at Highway 1 and River Street. City and county leaders say it has become a public health hazard. The city first said it was going to close the camp by March 15, which was then delayed to April 17. Now it seems that the camp's closure may be up in the air. Here's what you need to know about the city's plans for its homeless camps. First off, the city's plan for a new camp in a Washington Street parking lot is most likely dead. The plan would have created a place for homeless people to sleep next to Depot Park. The plan, which the city called a safe sleeping and storage site, would have allowed people to store their belongings there, but would have forced campers to leave each morning. At last week's Santa Cruz City Council meeting, dozens of Depot Park neighbors turned out in opposition. The council voted to reconsider the plan at the next meeting on April 9. Councilmember Cynthia Matthews, who was a deciding vote to approve the Washington Street camp, said she no longer supported the plan. On Tuesday, in an open letter to the community, City Manager Martine Bernal said that the city is no longer pursuing a safe sleeping and storage site. When the City Council rejects the Washington Street camp plan, as it is expected to on Tuesday, the city will not pursue another site for a safe sleeping camp. I talked with Eileen Cross, the city's community relations specialist, on Tuesday afternoon. She said, despite the rumors, the Jesse Street Marsh is not being considered as an alternative site.
We have not been given any direction to provide any alternative site, so that's about all I know at this point. We're not pursuing anything. There's nothing currently under consideration.
In a minute, we'll talk about what this development means for the closure of the Ross Camp. We'll meet after one short break. If you're joining us for the first time, Santa Cruz Local is a watchdog news startup co-founded by Stephen Baxter and me, Kara Miber Guzman. Our mission is to produce fair and accurate journalism that holds power to account. We had something we wanted to tell you about. We recently published a special report that details data on Santa Cruz's rental market. As the city enters a year-long process to devise policy for tenant protections, one thing has been sorely lacking from the debate: real numbers from neutral sources about the city's rental market. We filed several public records requests to get data from the city, the county, and the court system. We also got access to the real estate database, MLS. We share with you what we find. Visit our website, santacruzlocal.org, to check out the report. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on it. Email us at info@santacruzlocal.org or tweet to us at @thesclocal. Okay, so we know that the Washington Street Camp, which was supposed to provide 50 shelter beds, is probably not going to open as planned on April 17. Remember that the Washington Street Camp was part of the city's plan to close the Ross Camp. The city had the goal of creating 110 new shelter beds by the time it closed the Ross Camp. The city's second part of its plan, a camp at 1220 River Street, is still on schedule to open April 17. The 1220 River Street camp will provide 60 beds and will be professionally managed by the Salvation Army. Let's talk now with City Attorney Tony Candotti about what all this means for the planned closure of the Ross Camp. I spoke to him by phone on Tuesday. I asked him to break down Martin versus Boise, a federal court ruling from last year that said that cities can't outlaw sleeping in public if people have nowhere else to go.
The Martin versus Boise decision stands for the notion that the city can't enforce an ordinance against camping on public property with respect to a person who happens to be homeless if there is not another available or alternative location for that person to go and sleep. And so it does not stand for the notion that the city has a legal obligation to furnish shelter to, you know, all of the homeless people in the city. Rather, it just restricts the city's ability to enforce its camping ordinance when an alternative location isn't available. If there's an alternative place available for the current occupants of the Ross Camp to go, then the city could move forward with the closure of that camp, but it couldn't simply move in without providing some assistance to the occupants in finding another location.
So what does that mean for the closure of the Ross Camp? First off, the number of people in the Ross Camp is hard to pin down. It fluctuates each day. Last we checked, the city was trying to do a census at different times to get an accurate number. If the Ross Camp has more than 60 people, then they couldn't all fit at 1220 River Street. There are three other shelters open in the city right now, and usually there are open beds to be found there. For example, last week there were about 12 open beds each night at the Laurel Street shelter, according to Rainey Marr, the county's homeless services coordinator. So back to the Ross Camp. For the city to enforce the Ross Camp's closure, there would have to be enough shelter beds elsewhere in the city. If existing shelters aren't enough, Candotti said one idea might be hotel vouchers. If you would like to share your ideas with the City Council on the closure of the Ross Camp, be sure to email them this week at citycouncil@cityofsantacruz.com or attend the meeting on Tuesday.
And Santa Cruz Local will be a regular feature here on KSQD. We are very grateful to Kara Myberg Guzman as well as Stephen Baxter for supplying these short news stories from Santa Cruz City Council issues. And we'll run another one tomorrow morning and also Monday. So you can look for those every couple of weeks here on KSQD 90.7 FM. It's time now for First Person Singular, and that will be followed by Spotlight on Watsonville. If you like what you hear here on K-Squid, please do give us a call at 900-5773. That's in the 831 area code, 900-KSQD. We would love to hear from you, or you can email us at info@ksqd.org. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman. This has been Talk of the Bay. We'll see you next week.